This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health, and timing is everything. The Auditor General's report, which focused on healthcare, was released yesterday, and we've been talking about it. But now I am especially keen to hear whether our doctors, who are on the front lines of this, think the items that Shelley Spence highlighted are the things that are in the biggest need of a fix. Also, as you heard in Jeremy's news, some disturbing findings on prostate cancer, which overall has a very high survival rate, but new research says more men are being diagnosed at stage four when the disease is incurable. Also, I have a bunch of vaccine questions. And if you have questions, the number to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, who is a medical oncologist with the Princess Margaret Cancer Center and the former head of BC Cancer, Dr. Fahad Razak, a general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hello and welcome to you all. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby.
Okay, let us begin with you, Elisa. And one of the criticisms in the Auditor General's report said that the province is not doing a good enough job of connecting people with family doctors. We've talked about this often. What the province sort of announces additions to family health teams or whatnot in dribs and drabs, so it's very hard to get a full picture. And one of the issues is Health Connect, which is a system people are supposed to get onto if they are looking for a family doctor. Not enough people are on it. But my question is, whose fault is that? And what, if anything, should be done about it?
I think you're right. People just don't know that Healthcare Connect exists. I think the program does a good job of being able to match people to a family doctor. But the problem is that people don't even know that this program exists, one. And two, in that lots of family doctors aren't actually connected with Healthcare Connect. So the Auditor General actually brings up a really valid point, and that there is this push to have a family doctor, and the numbers around how many people don't have a family doctor is based on methodology that seems very weak and probably not accurate at all. The problem really is that there has been no push to tell people that this program exists. I've said before that my clinic, we're part of a group, and we got approved in the spring. And when we will be taking people, we still haven't found anybody to work here, as an update. The people will be coming off of Healthcare Connect. And so the clinic will, in order for people to become, who will be, there'll be 800 patients, and those 800 patients will come from Healthcare Connect, because the program is based on where people live, and that people need, who are live in underserviced areas, will get access. So a whole revamp of this whole process for the way in which people access primary care needs to happen. And hopefully this report will help to show people and the government that this, that there needs to be a coordinated effort to get both the patient and the practitioner connected through this program, because the program does work, just nobody knows about the program.
Okay, I'm going to get to that in a minute, but before I move on, just a question, Elisa. So why would doctors not be connected with it?
So some of it involves that, like for me, I'm not taking any patients at this time, so I wouldn't be connected. Every day I'll get a request from somebody, just random people within the community will reach out to the clinic and see if I'm taking patients, or I'll get requests from existing patients that could their family member or their friend or somebody that they know is looking for a doctor and would I take them. So for me, it's just that I'm not taking it. And some doctors just don't like to have government involved and want to be able to take patients, the number of patients that they want. And so that's probably one of the reasons why there, when at my old clinic, when we were affiliated with Healthcare Connect, as we were growing a clinic and we were looking for patients, there would be an incentive for the doctors to take on patients who were connected through Healthcare Connect. So there could be a financial incentive. I think just sometimes doctors are suspicious about and very guarded in terms of how they take patients into their practice.
Fahad, I mean, it's ironic. I don't want to spend too much time on ad spending because we're going to be looking at that in the back half of the show. But while this government, according to the Auditor General, has a record ad spend, most of it, by the way, in the United States, they haven't really spent money trying to advertise Healthcare Connect. Fahad, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me, Libby? Can you hear
Yes.
me? Yeah, hi, sorry
Yes.
about that. Yeah, as you said, I think the commenting on the value proposition of the American ads is above my pay grade, so I'll stay away from that one. But I will say that there seems to be really a disconnect between Healthcare Connect in terms of how many people it covers and the broader problem of primary care access in this province, which, in other words, the majority of people who don't have primary care doctors are not on Healthcare Connect. So you need a mechanism to look at those people. Healthcare Connect could be a good proxy indicator. That's great. But you need a mechanism to look at the large number of people who are not on Healthcare Connect who don't have primary care doctors. And I would say this audit also highlighted some other areas which are frankly just egregious and shocking. And I think it really highlights some of the highly abnormal and questionable billing practices by some physicians in the province as well. You had examples of some physicians claiming that they were working 366 days a year, which of course we know is not possible. People claiming that they're working, 24, 48, 72 hours straight without a break. And all of this, just to explain to your audience, this enhances the billing remuneration when they make these kinds of claims. The digital data in the province can easily flag these people. And in the coverage of the Auditor General's report, some of the highlights were that some of the physicians who have been flagged by this have been flagged in the past, and still they are doing this. So I think one of the nice things that the ways of framing it that was made by the Auditor General is this is money being pulled out of the healthcare system that could be used for things like primary care, things that we value enormously. So I do think that is part of the important finding from this report as well.
And I wanted to ask about that. Was she seemed to say that it's we don't have the technology, that we don't have software that could easily do that. But what I'm hearing from you is that actually we do.
I think we can do a lot more than we currently are doing, and I think this represents a, like, frankly, a caution that the government is using around flagging these kinds of abnormal physician billing practices, cognizant of a negotiation that is always ongoing with the OMA, Ontario Medical Association, around physician remuneration. But I do think that everyone can align that highly irregular billing practices like this, which, I'm not a lawyer, I don't want to use words like fraudulent. Of course, these things have to be adjudicated in the courts, but that these kind of practices need to be flagged. Again, I don't want to claim that this is happening frequently. It's clearly not, by the way that the Auditor General has reported this, but it is egregious, and there are some examples. And I think from a physician perspective, I would say it is, we are fortunate to be a self-regulated profession. Part of that is stepping up and ensuring that even isolated examples like this are quickly recognized, flagged, and dealt with. I think it is our responsibility, because if we lose the public's trust, it's extremely hard to get that back.
Malcolm, there's some important cancer news, but before we get to that, I wanted to ask about the Auditor General's item on the PPE? Because sometimes I think I'm the only person that remembers 2020. And yes, there was a huge amount of waste, but we found ourselves without current stockpiles of PPE. And I remember there was a huge batch that we got that was bad. I doubt we got our money back from China, I think it was. And in some cases, I think we had to sign very long-term orders in order to get the PPE. So do you think there was still a big problem with that, or was it pandemic-related?
You know, I think, first of all, I'd kind of like to step back for a second on this. So I think, you know, we're spending tens of billions of dollars on healthcare, and it's a very complex system. And so I think we need to be looking at the system critically every year and sort of saying, what are we not doing well? What can we do better? And I think it would be nice if we could separate this from the blame piece. Like, this is just good governance to look at how we're spending money and things we could do better. And unfortunately, this falls into the political realm that, you know, if there's a problem, then it's the fault of the government of the day, and the opposition makes hay with these guys are incompetent. I think we should actually all embrace this and say, look, inevitably in a complex system like this, you're going to have areas where things could be improved. And I think it would be nice if everyone embraced that, and rather than worrying about who's to blame, how do we fix it? So the doctor's billings is a good example. You know, as a doctor, I would want better governance on the amount that's paid out in billings. We need to make sure that we're paying for services that are actually delivered. And as a profession, if we have some bad apples who are taking advantage of the system, it reflects badly on all of us. And as a taxpayer, I'd say the same thing. If we're giving billions of dollars to doctors, I'd like to make sure that it's done appropriately. I think the PPE thing, to me, is a bit more complicated, because there are many examples where, in the panic of 2020, people struck deals to supply, to buy PPE, which in many cases were never really delivered on. There were scam artists, or the stuff was delivered and it was no good. And I think it's unfortunate, but I think it's more of a reflection of just how, I think we're all trying to forget how bad 2020 yeah. was. We were frightened, and we didn't have enough PPE for healthcare workers, and healthcare workers were getting sick. So mistakes were inevitably made, but I think the intention, which was good, is people were trying to get hold of stuff so that at least the people delivering healthcare could be safe. So I think we have to accept that, look at how we might do these things better, be better prepared. But I don't think we need to crucify people for some of those decisions that were made.
Yeah, I mean, that's what strikes me. I remember all of that. I know so many people are just put it out of their minds. There was a thing in there, Fahad, about distributing PPE. So when you get PPE in the hospital, do you get the right stuff, or are there problems on that end as well?
I mean, my personal experience has been that after, you know, what was really a crisis period in those early days where we were out, completely out of PPE, we were taking our masks and our face shields and putting them in envelopes and labeling them with our names, and then wiping them down with antiseptic the next day and putting them back on. Like, it was really something. I've never seen anything like that since. We're well stocked. I haven't seen, you know, I don't open up the drawer that's outside a patient room and see a bunch of masks or other things which are misplaced or anything like that. So to me, it strikes me that after that crisis period, at a clinician level, I'm finding it to be a very smooth process. Now, this broader question around procurement, it's complicated. I think Malcolm gave it a very nice perspective. This is, you know, we came from a period where we ran out. There was bad deals made. They enhanced procurement. Now we have a surplus. But imagine if things turned and suddenly we had, you know, like, for example, this winter, there's worry around the specific variant of flu that's coming through, H3N2. Australia had the worst flu season on record, and they normally predict what happens here. Imagine that we have, and the flu season is just starting. We're at under 10% positivity still. Imagine that we have an overwhelming flood of patients coming in. We're going to need that PPE. So this is a very hard thing to allocate precisely around. I would like us to be overly prepared rather than run into the, you know, frankly, scary situations that we ran into in early 2020.
Yeah, and just to put a cap on this subject, I'm remembering after SARS, Teresa Tam, who was, you know, still in the saddle when COVID hit, she had warned, I think, around 06, that we had to have our stores of PPE. And I can see if a government is trying to cut money saying, what do we need to keep buying this stuff? And lo and behold, we were caught short. So I just want to put that out there. And there are other things as well. I mean, there's Tamiflu that's been thrown out and a lot of the vaccines. And I will get to the vaccines in the moment. But Malcolm, first, what about this study that says that more men are being diagnosed for prostate cancer at stage four? Malcolm?
Oh, sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, so This is quite a complicated area. It would be nice if there was a simple answer to this. So the reality is that we do have PSA, which can be used as a screening test, and there is no question that with PSA, you do pick up cancers at an earlier stage. The challenge is, and has always been, that you also pick up a lot of cancers which would never have any significant impact on the person who has it. So it's said that by the time we get to 85, all men will have prostate cancer or some evidence of cancer in their gland, but only a small fraction of them will actually die from it. So the challenge has always been that you pick up some cancers, but you end up treating a lot of people who don't require treatment. And in doing so, you cause harm, impotence, incontinence, et cetera. And so it's a complex equation, and you're dealing with an older population. So people are looking at data sets and trying to glean some information that might reflect on what's happening out there. And this is not in what I'd call a tier one journal. This is in what we call a low impact journal. So that means that, you know, the high quality studies end up in the high tier journals. And I mean, I think the challenge is how do you define stage four? As we get more sophisticated with diagnostics, like the PSMA scan, are we able to detect? Or are we able to call certain things stage four, whereas 10 years ago, we wouldn't have the technology to do the test and actually declare it stage four. So it's data, but I don't think it tells us that we should be screening or we should not. The big thing that's changed in prostate screening is the big European prostate screening study, which was done many years ago, which ultimately concluded that there was no value in screening. As they followed those patients longer, what they've seen is that the impact of the screening is actually greater than they first estimated. And so I think people are starting to relook at the screening area and saying, hey, maybe there is evidence to suggest we should start doing population screening. So that's what's going on in the field at the moment. And we may start to see some of the preventive health committees recommending this, certainly in certain men above a certain age.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Do you think people should take the PSA test, which, by the way, is not covered by OHIP? Have I asked a yes or no question?
Well, unfortunately, it's not a yes or no question. If it was a yes or no question, we'd have an answer. You know, clearly in men who have a family history, et cetera, yes, definitely. But again, it's and then this comment, well, it should be an individual discussion between the family doctor and the patient. But I mean, in a way, for complex things like this, what we actually rely on is people to look at all of the data and come up with conclusions. I think that the issue for the individual patient is, okay, hey, we do this. This may reduce your chance of dying from prostate cancer by about 13%, but the risk is that you may end up requiring a surgery, which would make you incontinent and impotent, that may actually not be beneficial to you. So those are tough discussions. And I think this area is in flux, and probably as more data comes in, we'll have clearer recommendations around prostate screening in the next few years.
Okay. Alisa, I was quite dismayed to learn that an older family relative has shingles, did not complete the Shingrix vaccines, and likely is also behind on other vaccines. I bet that a lot of people are in that situation. So I have a question about spacing. So if you need to get your Shingrix, does it interfere then with getting the regular flu and COVID shots and also the RSV shots, which are covered for people over 75? So what kind of a schedule do people have to be on, or is there no impact of, you know, getting them all as soon as it gets on your radar?
So that's correct. So there is no reason that you couldn't get the shots all at the same time. So just to go back, the shingles vaccine is a two-dose series. So you get your first shot and you get your second shot 2 to 6 months after the first shot. And then there would be no reason why you couldn't combine a shingles shot with either a flu shot, a COVID shot, or an RSV shot. When the RSV shot first came out 3 or 4 years ago, because it was new, there was the restriction that you only got, you got that shot and you waited 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after to get another shot so they could see what the implications of the shot and looking to see if anything happened on it as more people got the shot. But that usually happens when something gets introduced for the first time, but there's no current restriction in terms of the number of shots that you can get at one time. So there's no reason why somebody couldn't go and get a COVID and a flu shot in the same day. And people are starting to come into the office now who are being sick and who I presume have influenza. And so people should be encouraged that even though there might not be an exact match with this H3N2 variant that's circulating with what's available in the vaccine, people should still be encouraged to get the shot, because people are coming in who haven't had the vaccine and they're just not happy and very sick and very and not feeling well, not a typical cold symptoms, but you feel much worse. And so everybody should be encouraged and everybody should go and still has a chance now and should take that opportunity and get it now before the season continues to get worse.
And is there a way that a patient themselves can tell, do you have a cold or do you have a mild case of the flu?
So usually when people will come in and we assume that they have influenza, their symptoms are worse than a cold. So when it's a cold, you might have a sore throat, you might have some nasal congestion, and maybe a cough. These people come in and they're just like, I always say to people, do you feel like you were run over by a truck? And they're like, yeah, you just have no energy, you're running a fever, you usually have a cough as your main symptom, and a lot of muscle fatigue. And they come in and they just have this exhausted look, as opposed to somebody coming in and they have a little bit of some nasal congestion or a sore throat that usually goes away within a couple of days. So people often recognize that they're feeling worse than they would with a normal cold. And then they come in to see what can be done to help them feel better.
Okay, I'm just going to take a call from Ron in Guelph, who has a question about the Shingrix vaccine. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for taking my call. I know I only got a minute or so. So I was trying to understand the logic of this whole thing, where you can only get the Shingrix vaccine paid for by the government if you're between 65 and 69. Where did the health department come up with that figure? Why? I mean, the logic.
Okay, that's not Ron. That's not a medical question. That's a political question, we're out of time. So I'm just going to answer it quickly. They say that according to what they found, that's where it had the most benefit. Obviously, they didn't want to pay for it for everyone. But that's a political question more than a medical one. Thanks for your call. And on that note, I'm going to wrap the panel out. Very interesting discussion and lots of good advice. And people, get out there and get your shots, because I can tell you that my family member who has shingles, it is very unpleasant. Thank you so much, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Fahad Razak, and Dr. Malcolm Moore. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Lily.
Bye.
Okay, we are going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to the Auditor General herself, Shelley Spence.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, when the Liberals were in power at Queen's Park, the Progressive Conservatives often lambasted them about the amount of money spent on advertising. Well, now the shoe is on the other foot, and it's the Auditor General who has brought our attention to record ad spending, $112 million in the last fiscal year, with most of the money directed to the United States for media campaigns there rather than spending it with Canadian media companies like us, Zoomer Media, who really need it. So I'd like to welcome Shelley Spence, Ontario's Auditor General. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start with some things that just came up in my medical panel, which includes somebody who is an expert in the healthcare data. And your report says that it's old technology is the reason that OHIP can't flag all this, these overbillings. But he says, and he wasn't specific that it's OHIP software, that we probably actually have the data that can be mined in the healthcare system to flag those things.
Well, and that's exactly what we did in our oversight of physicians' billing report. We got a hold of the data from the fee-for-service system, which is OHIP, and we were able to take that and use data analytic tools to point out some outliers. So we asked the data, how many doctors bill more than 24 hours a day or more than 365 days a year? How many doctors are seeing over 100 patients a day? And we were able to look at the data and pull out those anomalies. And it's in our report that you can see the different tables that we put together from the data. And we asked the ministry to, they should be investigating these kind of high-risk billings.
So what's the holdup then? If you were able to pull it out, is it that there aren't enough people to do the analytics? They don't know how to do the analytics? Or is that beyond your scope? Like, why is it not being done if we can do it?
Well, the way they were doing auditing before or investigations was based on tips or complaints. So it's very reactive. And, you know, this is looking at it from a more proactive basis. And we did recommend that they use tools like we did and scour the data and then direct their auditors to look at those specific high-risk billings as opposed to just if a complaint came in to them.
The other thing that was flagged, like some of these unidentified bad apples who overbill or allegedly overbill have done it more than once, and some of these cases have dragged on and on. Is there a way to streamline it?
Well, for the ones that we identified in our data mining, the ministry themselves had not identified any of them except for one pediatrician. So in that case of the pediatrician, it does go to another agency to be investigated, and there's a lot of back and forth. And some of those cases, I think there's 29 cases that the ministry's referred. Some of them are over a year long that are still in backlog. So you know, that is the mechanism, the legal mechanism for investigating after the ministry has done their work.
So do you have recommendations for making that more efficient?
We do. We pointed out that there's only 8 people that do this work, which is a low amount, and they have asked for more people in the past, and we kind of assume that that would be a good thing, but also taking those people and directing them to more proactive basis, so looking at this high-risk billing, as opposed to just following up on only complaints and being reactive.
Mm-hmm. So it's a manpower issue. It's an analytics issue. I'm assuming they would have to be trained to do this. Before we move on to the ads, there, one of the other glaring things to me is you were complaining that Healthcare Connect doesn't reflect the number of people who are looking for a family doctor. Now, all the doctors that I talk to say people don't know about Healthcare Connect. So on the one hand, there's a record ad spend, but it's going to the United States mostly. And I haven't seen or heard of advertising that would tell people about something like Healthcare Connect.
Well, that is one of our findings, is that only about 11% of people that need a family doctor had registered with Healthcare Connect. And even those that had, about 108,000 of them as of January, were waiting more than a year to be connected to a doctor. So, I mean, the question is, does anybody know about Healthcare Connect? And the answer there is not enough people know. But then if everybody got on there, would they be able to find a physician? It does exist. And, you know, I hope even our report will bring more attention to it. But the government themselves had not been widely communicating that its existence. So that's one of our recommendations, again, is to either, you know, get the system so it works for users, and also to let people know that it exists.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm looking at it. I mean, we have some guests on after you. It's a big issue in the Canadian media landscape. Full disclosure affects us as well, which is all the advertising that goes to the American behemoths, of also from this government. And here we are with something where people need to know things about their own health. Like, this is how you try to get connected, and those things are not advertised. Did you find a percentage of ads that you found were self-serving in a partisan way as opposed to useful ads?
Yes, we take a look at the ads of the day, and we compare them to what the old Advertising Act was, which had much more information on what looked partisan or not. And that act was changed in 2015 by the former government to, as you mentioned in your intro, much to the dismay of this party. But after that change, the Auditor General could not turn down ads. And it's some of the ads that we've been seeing. So we saw about 38% of the spend was on those kind of ads that we felt didn't have the information that people would need. They had claims of, you know, jobs and economic impact and things like that that were unproven because they're future orientated information. So, you know, we can't really say this was information that was really helping the citizens of Ontario understand a program or a service, like, as you mentioned, Healthcare Connect. The other thing about the Act, if I could just add, is that it doesn't, before and now, it doesn't stop advertising from happening outside of Canada. So it's not in the legislation at all that there couldn't be international ads.
Just to clarify for people, the Liberals loosened the rules for advertising. The Tories, then the progressive Conservatives, totally lambasted and criticized them for it. But when the progressive Conservatives got into power, They looked at it and said, oh, I think we'll leave it like it is, mm-hmm. loose. Mm-hmm. Just to clarify for people that that is what happened. So do you think that there has to be a return to more stringent rules?
Well, that is our recommendation, and it's the same recommendation every year, which is to go back to the old act. And if you do look at my report online, you'll see what the old act looked like versus the new. But to return to the old act, but also to add social media advertising to the act, because we don't review social media in that digital form. It's not part of our purview.
Hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? You table your report. The government says we're going to look at it. But what is actually going to happen to it? And how can you make sure that it doesn't just collect dust?
We will come back in 2 years' time and ask our auditees how far they've gotten in implementing the recommendations. And I'll say for the most part, the government has agreed to our recommendations. So they've said, yeah, that's a good idea. So then we come back in 2 years and say, well, where are you in getting this to happen? And sometimes there's no progress because it's a longer term recommendation. Sometimes there is some progress. So we keep up on it and keep asking them, are you getting this done? We'll come back again in 5 years' time for the final look to see if they have implemented the recommendations. Both of those reports are public, and they will be coming out in a week's time. So you can see how we followed up on older audits in the two-year and five-year reports.
Okay, well, that's a good idea. Thank you so much, Shelley Spence. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we are taking another break, and we are going to follow up on this question of a record ad spend and the fact that most of it is going to the United States. And I seem to recall this government promising 25% of their ads would be spent at home. And I have a very strong hunch that that has not happened. So we'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we are going to continue this conversation about the progressive conservative Ford government's record ad spend. And people, I want to hear from you. Is this a good use of our taxpayer money? Most of that is going to the United States. Remember those Reagan ads, and I don't believe that those were even included in this Auditor General's report, and it was a whopping $75 million U.S. That's over $100 million Canadian. Anyway, the numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-744-740. And let's bring in Liberal MPP and Interim Leader John Fraser and Sarah Thompson, Executive Managing Director of Glassroom Toronto. Hello, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Okay, let us begin with Sarah. So first of all, were you surprised when you saw a record ad spend? And what do you make of it?
I mean, it's a normal spending pattern when you're coinciding with an election cycle. So it's not a surprise there. You also always have to factor in that, like everything, media also is affected by inflation. So costs for executing media have risen. The one area that I would call out, and you were just discussing previously, is how much money is actually leaving the Canadian media economy. We committed a study called Canadian Media Means Business. And while more often than not, we look at advertising as some sort of frivolity, it actually does create jobs. A dollar in advertising in any local market economy, provincial or federal, creates a dollar to our gross domestic product. So the question is, much like the auditor called out, is we need to understand that social media investment, the platform investment that is in place, $12.8 million, when you look at where they are investing their money, is significant. It's more than radio in our province, which is in a very effective community-based medium, much like what
I think you don't have to tell me about that. We're very
aware. Yeah, and you spoke before about the dedication of 25%, and it's 25% in digital advertising. And there are a lot of community newspapers in Ontario that have benefited, that have added journalists to their newsrooms because of that investment. But I will call out that $12.8 million. That means money has left our gross domestic product that could have created jobs in our province.
Yes, and you know, it's going to these very large American behemoths, and they aren't going to be covering local news. I mean, one of the glaring things I saw, I just talked to a medical panel that said, nobody knows about Healthcare Connect, which was flagged in the Auditor General report, and there hasn't been advertising on it, and that would have been local advertising.
100%. I think, too, that if you think about, like, radio stations like yours deliver high attention to advertising. And when you're on a platform, that is the lowest form of attention given to ads. So you can be investing $12.8 million in that platform in things that are invisible to Ontarians that they never even saw. So it goes with, how are we planning these dollars, investing wisely, making sure that they're community-based, and supporting our local infrastructure, including journalists, media agencies like mine. We get jobs out of those dollars. But if they leave our province, there's no job creation associated with that.
Exactly. John Fraser, what's your take on this? John, are you there? Okay, we were supposed to be talking to... Oh, I see him now. John Fraser, are you there?
I'm there. You were breaking up a bit, so I called back.
Sorry, go ahead. What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, look, our money should be spent here. There's no question about that. And, you know, hearing that so much of it's going south of the border is very concerning. The thing that really concerns me is, number one, the amount that they're spending, which is a record amount, $112 million. And by comparison, that's more than Canadian Tire spends and a little bit less than twice as much as Tim Horton spends on advertising across Canada, in Canada. And a growing portion of that are ads that aren't to connect people to healthcare. They're there to tell us how great things are, about the Ring of Fire, about protecting Ontario, when in fact the advertisement is not really protecting any jobs in Ontario. And, you know, the Auditor General's raised concerns about those ads, you know, being partisan. That's the way it's described. There was a law that I worked for the person who brought in the law, but, you know, some more than 20 years ago, Premier Dalton McGuinty. It was changed. At the time it was changed, it should never be changed, because there's just too much of a temptation to spend that.
Well,
money.
that was my next question. So it was a Liberal government, your government then, that loosened the rules for advertising, and the Progressive Conservatives lambasted that at the time, but then said, "Oh, let's keep this; it's good for us." Yeah. So, what are you saying now?
What I said at the time to my colleagues when we were doing it is, we don't need to do this. It's actually, when we spend money on ads, it should be to connect people to health, you know, to things like Healthcare Connect, to get vaccinated, to know where to go if you've got a problem, or a significant change in maybe how, you know, renewing your driver's license, to give people information that they need and that they use, not to say that our government's great and everything's rosy. You know, $112 million could have been spent on in our schools, in our hospitals, hiring more nurses, done things that matter most to people, and you know, whatever government of any stripe should be focused on those things. And so that's, you know, that's my biggest concern. I think a lot, I don't think a lot I should have ever changed. I don't. And I think that we should bring it back to what it was, because, you know, it came out of a government not using ads improperly. Actually, there was, you know, we had to actually put in the law at the time, this is 20 years ago, that like the premier can't appear in an ad that's paid for by for government. By government, I should say.
Okay, just to wrap things up, Sarah Thompson, what would you like to leave us with? And is should there be some kind of lever to make sure that, that government ads are spent here in Ontario?
I think it always also depends on what the mandate is. If we're using government ads to recruit talent to our province, if we're using it to attract business, then yes, you have to have advertising in other countries. But in this instance, I call out the lack of transparency in platform investment of where are those dollars going. And I do agree with the Auditor General, that should be audited. That should be evaluated of the performance. What isn't spoken to is this is spend. What we're missing from the other piece of this puzzle is effectiveness. And it's very clear that there are spots and places where this didn't effectively reach Ontarians with some of the messages that the government wanted to reach. I won't speak to the partisanship, but I will speak to advertising well-planned and invested in Canada and quality media always works. So where is that money going and how was it actually invested when we're losing $12.8 million?
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Sarah Thompson and John Fraser. And now, very quickly, real estate, which is a big favorite topic around here. And for a long time, the conversation has been around eye-popping prices and the near impossibility of owning a home for so many younger people. But now the latest numbers show Toronto area home sales plummeted in November and prices declined for the 10th month in a row. So will this give people an opportunity to get into the market? Jason Mercer is the Chief Market Analyst and Director at the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board. Hi, Jason.
Good afternoon.
So is this going to help people?
Well, I mean, certainly what we've seen over the last number of months as we move through, especially the second half of 2025, is an improvement in affordability. And so buyers have had more negotiating power. So we've seen the average price trend lower, as you mentioned in your introduction. We've also seen mortgage rates trending lower as well. And so if you think about a home purchase from a monthly payment perspective, you know, that's gotten a lot more positive for a lot of would-be home buyers. I think the issue that we're facing now is that while affordability has improved and there's a lot of people who have every intention on purchasing a home, they put that decision on hold because they're less confident in the economic situation, especially related to the trade issues we're having south of the border.
So what are you expecting to see going forward? I mean, we're all kind of trained to think, well, gee, if the prices go down, if it becomes easier, then that'll lead to another spike. But are you saying you don't think that will happen?
Well, I think ultimately, the more affordable housing market conditions we're seeing today versus, say, the same time last year, I think, you know, that will result in an increase in home sales in the months ahead. I think the main wild card is, you know, how long it will take for consumers to be confident that they're going to retain their employment and ideally see their incomes increase. And, you know, when you look at, you know, both polling done for Treb, but also, you know, other polling we're hearing about in the marketplace, you know, consumers are less confident today than they were a year ago, say before President Trump was elected, because there's a ton of uncertainty now in terms of, you know, where our economy is going to go. I think we have seen some good news over the last month or so. There's good employment numbers, good overall GDP numbers. And I think if that continues, you know, that'll give people some confidence that, you know, we have been able to mitigate, at least to a certain degree, issues of trade. We've seen lots of announcements about infrastructure projects and what have you.
Just before we wrap things up, what about the condo market? There are a lot of people who say the condo market is basically done, crashed. Do you agree with that description? We have about a minute left.
Well, we continue to see condo sales reported. I think the big story in the condo market, at least on the resale side, is there's a ton of inventory. And so if I were a first-time buyer, for example, looking to get into the market for the first time, I'd be taking advantage, again, from the most negotiating power that we've seen in the last, say, decade to decade and a half. And so the ability to negotiate a good price and take advantage of lower borrowing costs is certainly there. It's just a matter of if you feel confident that you're going to be able to make those payments month in and month out over the long term.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Jason Mercer. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Bye now.
Okay. That is all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on YouTube. And I'll be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.